Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going to spend the morning in the forest. We're going to spend it with some trailblazers. We're going to hear how you can help those in need on Thanksgiving. And we'll wind up in the pickle patch talking about field hockey. Intrigued? I hope so. First, it's Into the Woods we trek to learn about a group that works to protect, preserve, and restore forests on Vermont's federal and state public lands. It's called Standing Trees Vermont, and joining us to explain what they do and why is Mark Nelson. Mark, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Glad to be here, Rick. Thank you.
You're welcome. And we also will be talking with Zach Porter. Zach, thank you for being here as well.
Yeah, thanks, Rick.
Sure thing. Zach and Mark are the co-founders of Standing Trees Vermont. And listeners, if you'd like to ask our guests a question about Standing Trees Vermont, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255 is the toll-free number. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Mark, what is Standing Trees Vermont?
A good question, Rick. And you mentioned that Zach and I are co-founders. We're some of the co-founders of Standing Trees Vermont. Because it's an interesting group that came together. It's a very diverse, what we call a coalition of concerned citizens and some nonprofits that, as you said, we're working to protect, preserve, and restore Vermont's forests on federal and state lands. We do have a website, if I could pitch it for a second, standingtreesvermont.org, that people can go to and learn a lot more about us. But we came together rather by accident as a result of some other discussions, online discussions about other issues related to forests. And as people became aware of what was happening in the Green Mountain National Forest, the amount of additional logging that was occurring is how the group organized. And, you know, just a little background. So, Rick, if I could, you know, prior to European settlers, Vermont was almost 100% forested. So then our forests were almost eliminated, right? Now we're about 75% forested. But our forests are really far away from fully recovering. They're recovering right now, but they're far away from what they were and what they could be. And protecting and restoring our wild forests is really critical to storing carbon, enhancing diversity, maximizing ecological values, reducing the threat of flooding, and improving our water qualities, is among many, many other things. And so what we want to do as Vermonters who care about Vermont is we would like to really see our public lands, federal and state, the forests on our federal and state land, managed in a way that we maximize their values and that we let those forests attain their old age and become what they were and what they can be. We are Vermonters, as I said. We live in wood houses. Many people in our group use wood stoves, and we know that Vermont needs some managed and wild forests, and we see these as complementary parts of our forest future. But, you know, we really would like to see our public lands, how we manage our forests on our public lands, which is what we're focusing on, be changed so that we can maximize their values. And one last thing in how we want to interact with folks is we want to be respectful, we want to be truthful, we want to be fact-based, and we listen to others. We want to hear all sides of the argument, but we also want to be listened to because we are advocating for something that's different than what's normally discussed out there.
Zach, Mark mentioned that, you know, you want to see these forests age, become old-growth forests. Why is that important?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. Well, you know, I think to a lot of folks, we just kind of intrinsically know the value of those older forests. But science in recent years has really caught up with what we, I think, all kind of know when we step into those rare older forests. You know, just 1/10 of 1% of Vermont represents anything like the forest that used to be here, that evolved over millennia with Vermont's original people, the Abenaki people. And what we know now is that those forests are key to our future. If we want to get through climate change, if we want to restore the water quality of our rivers and lakes, if we want to protect our communities from flooding, restore the biodiversity that's native to our region. We need to restore the native habitat of our region, which are these older forests. I think, you know, we look out the window and we see trees in Vermont, right? But there's a big difference between trees and forests. And the missing component, most of the time, is just that, time. We need to have the patience, the foresight, the humility to let these forests grow old once more. And we've got to start now. Right now, just 3% of Vermont's forests and about the same amount across New England are managed so that someday they'll actually become those old forests that once were. Compare that to New York across Lake Champlain. New York has 10% of its forests on a trajectory to reach that kind of condition someday in the future. 3% is not balanced forest management. And so, like Mark said, you know, we're not advocating for anything other than balanced management here. We appreciate that there is a role for managed forests as well as wild forests. And we're looking to kind of increase the parity between the two. And I'll just say this, too. You know, there's a great term, a scientist by the name of Joan Maloof uses the term ecological amnesia. And I think it really is accurate here in New England, where for, you know, three centuries now, we've been living in a place where we don't have a kind of reference point for what used to be here. How many Vermonters know that we used to have elk, caribou, wolves, wolverine, many species that don't exist here today, and species that we take for granted today, moose, beaver, were gone just a short while ago. So, you know, there's a lot missing from our forests. They are not healthy, I think, in any real definition of what a healthy forest should be here in New England. And so standing trees exist to correct this and to make sure that we're setting ourselves on a course to real forest health down the road.
Let's take a call. Fred is joining us from Bristol. Morning, Fred. Go right ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to comment on the speakers. I'm not sure they know. Maybe they do, but only about 10% of the land in Vermont is publicly owned. The rest is privately owned. And perhaps the emphasis of your thinking should go into influencing private landowners on how to manage their land. The public land is public land. You know, maximizing the potential of the land, it does not necessarily mean letting it grow up into old growth forest. I mean, that doesn't maximize wildlife diversity whatsoever. Just wanted your comment on that, and I'll listen in and maybe comment some more things.
Okay, thanks, Fred. So, Mark, you know, to Fred's point, you know, why are you focused on public lands as opposed to private lands?
And we had some debates about that. There's the issue of educating private landowners, okay? But private lands are private lands. And the state has a fair amount of work to educate private landowners on good silvicultural practices and forest management. It would be good if private landowners who wanted to let their forests grow old could be allowed to do that and still get some sort of benefit under UVA or something like that. But we're really focusing on the federal and the state lands because they are public lands, okay, number one. And number two, if you look at a map, there are maps that have been put together out there that show carbon densities of forests across the U.S. And when you look in the Northeast, specifically in Vermont, the Green Mountain National Forest and our state forests have the highest level of carbon density in the state and in the Northeast. Compare that to Maine, which has lots of trees, but their carbon density is much lower than Vermont's because they're logging pretty heavily up there. They let the trees regrow, but those are the reasons why we're focusing on the public lands. That's what, on the publicly owned, the federal and the state lands, because we think we have opportunities for impacts there.
And let me just jump in real quick
sure.
to say that just to clarify, public lands are about 20% of Vermont. 10% are federally managed. 10% are managed by the state. 20% are owned by you and me, right? These are public lands. And, you know, what are the public benefits that we all need from our forests? Clean air, clean water, carbon storage, flood mitigation, wildlife habitat. You know, just to be really clear, those are the things that we can derive the most of when we allow forests to grow old and wild. The science is really clear about this. In terms of habitat diversity, you know, like I said before, New England's forests, you know, the vast majority of them were these old forests. And when I say old forests, I think it's kind of a term that's a bit misleading, right? I'm talking about forests that have old trees, young trees, natural openings. We need all of the habitat for all of the species that used to live here. But we can get at that by allowing forests to grow old and naturally create that habitat diversity. Right now, what we have after 80% deforestation in Vermont is a landscape that is still very much in recovery. Our forests are pretty homogenous across the state. And so in time, we can restore that complexity. And you don't need to look very far to see what time does to forests. The Adirondacks, which were set on their forever wild path 125 years ago, gosh, if you travel over there sometime, take a walk in the woods, it is noticeable the difference between the forest on that side of the lake compared to the forest on this side. And what we need are to, you know, kind of get at those qualities that can really only come from giving more of our forests, not all of them, more of our forests, the space and time. And, you know, scientists are saying we need to put 30% at least of our forests on a trajectory to someday, you know, have a kind of older condition, this complex structure. 50% is what some are saying is really more what's needed to rise up to our climate crisis. But right now, you know, we'd settle for the 9% that the state of Vermont has already set as a target. It's called Vermont Conservation Design. Vermont Forest Parks and Recreation and Vermont Fish and Wildlife produced this fantastic report in 2018 that says Vermont needs to have 9% of its forests on a trajectory to attain these characteristics. And so we're at 3%, like I said, right now. We need to get started. We need to make a plan to get there. And it makes sense to get there using public lands, first and foremost. Private lands, too, certainly, like Mark said, our current use program, use value appraisal program, needs updates to allow forest landowners to have their lands in a wild condition so that they're not mandated to log their forests. But on public lands, we can do a lot quickly to get to those to get to that 9% target.
We're loaded up with a lot of calls. Let's go first to Newbury and talk to Fred. Hi, Fred. Go right ahead.
Good morning. Hey, when you talk about forests, you have two types of forests. You have a deciduous and a conifer forest.
Mm-hmm.
So now we want to talk about an old forest. So how do you determine which forest is an old forest? How do you determine if a deciduous forest is an old forest? How do you determine whether a conifer forest is an old forest? And what is the definition of an old forest in age? And
all
how
right.
Long can an old forest? How long can an old forest be an old forest?
Okay, Fred, great question. Let's get to Mark on that. Mark, go right ahead.
That's a good and interesting question, and I don't know if I'm going to give the best answer on that because mm-hmm. I'd have to go out and look up some scientific information about that. But the issue is not whether it's deciduous or conifer. The old forest has to do with this age, okay? And the forests in the Northeast are not considered old according to nature and scientific views of them, not silvicultural views, but until they're like 100 and 150 years old. And we have very, very few areas of that in the state of Vermont. So it's not whether they're deciduous or conifer. We're looking at the overall age of the forests and from a natural perspective, and our forests are far from where they were at one time and what they could be. And if I could real quick just touch on something about diversity, Zach mentioned that, you know, right now our forests are homogenous. Many people say they're even aged. And the fact is, yes, they are, because they were cut and they're regrowing. And so you do have a lot of even-aged forests across here. But if you look at what will happen to a forest if you let it go naturally, so if a natural disturbance comes through and clears out an area, a windstorm, ice storm, whatever, over time as that forest regrows, there will be a period of time where it will be even aged. But then as you let it go over time and let natural occurrences continue, it will become uneven aged, it will become more diverse, it will support the plants and animals that were here many, many years ago before we clear-cut our forests. So it's a little bit of a long-winded answer, but that's how we're looking at it.
All right. Speaking of natural occurrences, I had an email from Coach who asked, and Zach, I'll direct this to you, do old forests equal more fire risk?
Yeah, great question. I'm really glad you asked that. So, you know, old forests actually reduce fire risk. This is true both in fire-adapted ecosystems of, you know, the, primarily the western U.S. and in our, you know, much moister, you know, eastern forests as well. And why is that? Well, you know, with an old forest, you have, you know, greater tree cover, which cools the forest floor. You have larger trees that can withstand, you know, the impacts of fires more easily than young forests can. You have less fuel buildup at the forest floor level than you do when you're walking through a, you know, recently clear-cut area, or, you know, think about like a power line right-of-way. You've got a tremendous amount of brush and low vegetation that is just ideal fuel for a fire. You know, older forests are more resistant to fire. They are more resistant to invasive species. You're much less likely to encounter, you know, those invasives when you're back in an interior older forest, you know, in Vermont than you are on the edge of, you know, towns and cities, on the edge of you know, or in the middle of a recent harvest. Roads, you know, bring in those species that we don't want to see in our forest, species that don't belong here. And so what we need are more of these kind of interior forest blocks to be managed lightly to maximize their resilience to our changing climate. Fire danger is not really has historically not been a big threat here in the Northeast. I don't even think that climate change will change that to a very large degree. But, you know, our forests, if we want to prepare them for fire, the best thing we can do is to actually let them grow older and increase that forest complexity and diversity. And so, you know, yeah, just like Mark said, mm-hmm. it's about age. It's not about deciduous or conifer.
Right.
And, you know, how we define forest as old, you know, Mark said 100, 150 years. That's when you just start to see those characteristics. Old forests in New England can go, you know, well, they'll continue to sequester carbon for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So, you know, we need to kind of differentiate between, you know, what an old forest is from the sense of like when it's, you know, merchantable versus what an old forest is from an ecological perspective. And our forests can grow for millennia and never really get old. They're just in their prime.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beauty of an old forest.
All right. Let's get one more call in. Bruce is joining us from Essex. Hey, Bruce. How you doing?
Good morning, all. And thank you for a very fundamentally important interview and show, Rick. And I want to congratulate Standing Trees Vermont for doing some essential public education. In my own research, I really believe that Vermont suffers from a lot of ecological ignorance, and it's also prevalent among our policymakers, so keep at it. I think the most important thing you said today is our forests are recovering, but not recovered. If we call them recovered, we're sort of patting ourselves on the back and thinking, look what a great job we've done, but we really haven't. And just a quick thing. Folks that want to learn more in picture terms about what's happened to our forests in Vermont and central New England should go to the website for Harvard Forest, which is in Petersham, Mass. They've got a great diorama and slides online, and the first one is about the pre-settlement forest and what it was like, and it's making many of the points you've made today. So really, thank you so much, and I look forward to learning more from you all and your organization.
All right. Thanks so much for that call. Let's go to Mark. So, you know, what Bruce is saying is, yeah, recovering, but not fully recovered. So we've got a couple minutes left. Can you kind of point out where we really need to focus our energies to make sure that we do have these forests recover and become old growth forests?
Okay, to wrap it up, I think I'm going to address a term that's relatively new out there called proforestation. And proforestation is a term for letting our forests be forests, allowing them to do their thing. Let them grow old, let them grow wild, let them become far more diverse, etc. And prior to the introduction of the term proforestation, we had deforestation, which is cutting forests, afforestation, which is establishing a forest on land that previously wasn't a forest, or reforestation, which is replanting trees in an area where they were impacted by either natural or human disturbances, okay? In 2019, Dr. Mumau and his colleagues did a study, and they came up with the term proforestation, which the term came from that. And that study showed that the average age of most of our managed forests out there is young. From an ecological time frame, right, as we've been saying. They're very young. They're recovering. They have not recovered. If we allowed them to grow to meet their ecological potential for carbon sequestration, that could accelerate for decades to a century or more. So they came up with this term proforestation, which is letting the forest recover, letting the forest do its thing. If we do this, okay, it's far less expensive. You let the forest grow. There's minimal manpower to do it. So all of these other options, you know, afforestation and reforestation, proforestation is the best way to go. Let our forests age. There was a scientific study from Dr. Keaton at the University of Vermont that showed that our forests could store 2 to 4 times more carbon if we just let them grow old. So the answer to your question is proforestation. Let our forests grow.
That's Mark Nelson.
Let me just add to that.
Well, we're out of time, Zach. I really apologize. But Mark Nelson, Zach Porter, two of the founders of Standing Trees Vermont. Listeners, to learn more about the work of the organization, you can visit standingtreesvermont.org. Zach and Mark, thanks so much for being on the program this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Sure. Take care. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll be back to hear about Vermont Works for Women's Trailblazers. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. There's nothing a woman can't do. This I know is true. But there are some professions where doors might be more difficult to open for them, where training hasn't been available to women. See a need, find a solution. That's the way to get things done. And that's exactly what Vermont Works for Women has done with the creation of Trailblazers. We're going to spend the next segment learning about the organization and the program. Joining me now is Ronnie Basden, Vermont Works for Women's Executive Director. Ronnie, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, great. And we also have Program Manager Missy Mackin. Missy, glad to have you here as well.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Hi. All right, listeners, if you've got questions about Trailblazers, the trades training program, or if you've known someone who's gone through it, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email us, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Ronnie, let's look at the big picture. What is Vermont Works for Women?
So Vermont Works for Women, we're a statewide economic justice organization. We really want to advance gender equity and support women and youth at every and all stages of their career journeys.
And what are some of the major initiatives of the organization?
Yeah, so our organization works in many different ways. So we have direct service programs that serve both youth and after-school and summer programming. And then we have programs for women and gender nonconforming individuals, hard skills training programs, employment support, career coaching, and just overall, whatever you might need to discuss or be connected to resources or however we can help you get the certifications to advance or find a career that really fits your needs.
Missy, what are some of the programs that you've overseen at Vermont Works for Women?
Well, when I started in 2017, I managed the Step Into Work program, which was a transitional jobs program we were running. And that's evolved over time. And I shifted when we got a federal grant for women in apprenticeships and non-traditional jobs to developing and managing the Trailblazers program. And I also wear another hat, which is facilitating, co-facilitating gender equity workshops and providing gender equity services to employers.
All right, a lot of hats. Today we're going to focus on the one that says Trailblazers. So give us an overview of what Trailblazers is, how it came about, and why.
Well, we had spent our organization began in the late 80s, and we spent many years training women in hard skills to get jobs in the trades and law enforcement and non-traditional fields. We had gotten away from that a little bit, partly because the fields had not gotten any friendlier or more welcoming to women. And in 2017, we applied for this WANTO grant, and it enabled us to revisit our roots and get back to training women in the skills so that they can get good paying jobs in the construction industry. And so it is, right now it's a 7-week program with 4 weeks of classroom and hands-on experience, and the participants earn their OSHA 10 credential and the NCCER core curriculum certification. And then after 3 weeks, they also do an on-site, on-the-job training with a local employer.
Ronnie Bansden, why was this the program that you really wanted Vermont Works for Women to provide?
So, one, this program has been in demand. You know, we have cohorts that we have seen full and across the state, and I think that shows that there's a need for gender-supported hard skills and soft skills training. You know, this program is unique in the sense that, yes, you're going to walk out with similar certifications that you could find in other environments, but that's also going to be paired with soft skills training to really build confidence to walk into these industries and on these work sites, along with a supported cohort that really wants to see you succeed. And one thing about Trailblazers that we find really unique is, yes, this does certify women to be prepared to walk into a job site, but we also feel that these skills you're learning through Trailblazers can really translate to any industry. It's building confidence. It's telling you that you can swing that hammer and, you know, fix that door. You can do all of the things that you want to accomplish. And this program does that in a very unique way. And it also partners our relationship with employers and really the job demands out there. But it says these jobs are available and you can choose to go after them if this is the right time for you. And so it's a really supportive program that has really been in demand and has seen success. And so why not continue to try to grow it?
Mm-hmm. Missy, let's talk more about the logistics of Trailblazers. How often is it held?
The class meets 2 nights a week from 5:30 to 8:30 and all day Saturdays. So that is a mixture, again, of the classroom and the hands-on practice. And and then during the final 3 weeks of the on-site work experiences, the students also meet on Fridays and Saturdays and hear speakers and do some of the other work around self-advocacy and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And it goes for 7 weeks. How often is it offered?
Well, we are planning to offer at least two this year. It's been dependent on funding the past 2 years, and so we're working to get a really regular schedule where we can tell people that it's definitely going to be offered, you know, in the spring and the fall.
Who can enroll?
Any female identifying individual age 16 or older.
And then who teaches the courses and what skills are taught?
We mix it up a little bit. The basics are carpentry, and those are taught by NCCER certified instructors. And then we also have other mentor teachers come in who are already in the trade. So we have usually do electrical basics, solar basics. Sometimes we're able to do HVAC basics. Right now the class has been able to do plumbing because the instructor at a Rutland class, Morgan Over, is a plumber who can also do all those other things. And at the class right now in Rutland at the Mint, they're also able to do a little bit of manufacturing, CNC learning. So sometimes it's in some ways dependent on the instructors we have available, but we try to give a good foundation in all those areas.
And Ronnie, what kind of support or guidance are you getting from the contractors in the trades who know about the program?
So we have wonderful employer partners that really work with us. One, I think there's a big demand in the trades right now, so there's an eagerness to partner with training programs where there's a potential workforce. But with our employment partners, one of the requirements that we have as an organization to work with our cohorts or to really work with the organization specifically in this program is they also have to complete one of our gender equity trainings, and that's just one of our touch points to really ensure that our participants are walking into foundational, respectful workplaces. And so we have really strong relationships in the sense that we provide training to their employees and they get to have on-site work training through some of the cohort participants and then potentially participate in a job fair where participants can look for potential positions at those and extend those work experiences into full-time careers.
What's the feedback you've gotten about your graduates from the contractors?
I can answer that.
Sure.
The contractors are, first of all, very excited to welcome the participants onto their sites. And we do a weekly phone call during those 3 weeks. I do one with every contractor so that we can keep up with how things are going and, you know, problem solve, troubleshoot any issues that may arise. And I'm really happy that there have not been any negative issues and all the feedback has been excellent. They feel that when the participants come to them, they're still pretty green. Some of them, they have a wide range of skills in their backgrounds. And so the employers just sort of meet them where they are and work with them. And the feedback has been wonderful, and as it has been from the participants about the contractors as well.
Oh, yeah. Missy, what challenges or reservations do you have to help women overcome who are considering entering Trailblazers?
That's a great question, Nick. The women are so interested in learning these skills. And because women don't grow up as many men have, being exposed to tools and fixing things and being taught how to do all those things, there's a real sense of uncertainty. And they really are unsure whether they can actually learn the skills or, you know, do the work, have that career. And so that's why a lot of what happens in the class, simply by teaching them how to use power tools, for example, builds their confidence in so many ways.
What type of commitment does it take, Missy, for those who enroll in the program?
Well, they need to be able to commit to showing up for every class. And there is also the NCCER component requires that they pass tests in 6 or 7 different modules, depending on the class, such as hand tools, power tools, construction drawings, material handling, and NCCR curriculum. You know, there's a whole online testing piece, and so they need to pass those tests in order to get their certification. And really then they just, it's a commitment really that they make to themselves that they're going to do this program. And it shows up in the way they approach it, because everybody shows up all the time.
Ronnie,
they can't wait to come to class.
Yeah. Ronnie, how do you see this program impacting the trades industry in Vermont?
It's great to see. And one, I think it's driving more women into the industry, providing more opportunities for families to have more economic independence and flexibility. And it's also just helping to change work sites and work environments in general. Really having more women helps drive more opportunities for family forward practices and for potentially stronger pay across the board. And so I think it does a lot to really move the needle forward for the industry and really show a different side. Along with that, it's really showing a different representation for the next generation to see.
And do you see this finding its way into vocational technical schools eventually and, getting younger women involved in the trades?
You know, we hope so. We also run middle school programming, or Rosie's Girls After School and summer programming, but also just as exploratory in construction and similar trades work, just to build that passion or potential motivation. And then we also run programming that hopefully will kick off soon, if COVID could ever go away, but that will be in the tech centers. And that's really trying to support tech center students through, one, their enrollment and then their retention into towards graduation in the tech center, so that we can drive more female representation there as well. We have great tech center programs across the state that could be so beneficial to so many of our youth. And so we're really trying to help in, one, those recruitment phases, but also the retention when they're at the tech centers.
Missy, can you give an example or two of someone who has enrolled in the class and gone on to a job in the trades?
Sure. I'm thinking of one woman in particular who has done a lot of things in her life and, as she said, is not so young anymore. And she graduated from the program early on, a couple of years ago, and has gone on to, she did a sort of a part-time learning apprenticeship with a local contractor who has taken on several of our participants, actually, and is just a very good teacher. And she went on to start a business with her partner where they, you know, will pretty much do whatever people need, small jobs, you know, roofing, siding, little remodeling jobs, things like that. So she's very happy doing that, and she can make her own schedule, and she's, saving some money and doing very well. And there's another one of the women went into she found herself an apprenticeship with a blacksmith.
Wow.
And so she's learning that trade, and she loves doing that. So, they go into all sorts of different fields.
Ronnie, what kind of placement does Trailblazers do to find jobs in Vermont for women coming out of the program?
You know, really, we don't do a lot of seeking out job opportunities. We're very lucky that we have great employer partners that really reach out to us, and we stay connected to know what's available and out there. We have a couple of different ways that women during the program and even after can continue to seek or look at what is available. Once you're in the program or graduate, there's a Facebook page. It's our Women in Trades Trailblazers, and that's just for women who have been in the program. It's only women and gender nonconforming individuals that have access to that closed group and will post job opportunities or what's available. Missy also stays incredibly connected to all of our participants as well. So if anything ever comes up, we really make sure to share that. But we really put the job search in the participants' hands. Some of our participants are not necessarily ready for full-time work or transitioning, and so we want to continue to make sure that they know what's out there But if a participant is ready to move right into a job, at the end of each program, there tends to be a job fair where our different employment partners can come together and really talk about what's available or what they could go into.
Missy, in addition. Yep, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, we've also recently seen that a couple of our participants have even just taken jobs as a continuation of their work experience, which is great to see.
Outstanding. And Missy, in addition to the hard skills, what other growth do you see in the individuals who have gone through the program?
Well, just the increase in self-confidence. And, the research shows that having the classes comprised just of women and female-identifying folks is so powerful because they really support each other and they become sort of a unit. And so it's not just networking, friendships are built and they help each other with whatever, finding jobs or housing and anything like that. And, we also work with them around self-advocacy, sexual harassment on the job and how to approach that and sort of, how to best go about the job search. And so, just the comments that the women make when they've been through the program is that they just didn't know what to expect, and in many cases it goes beyond their expectations. And one of my favorite comments, I don't know if I can say this on the air, so you might need to believe me, but
be careful.
Somebody said basically. Many people have said it's so amazing to meet and learn from these awesome instructors.
Yeah. All right. So. When's the next class? Do you have a date for the next class?
We do. We're planning to start mid-April in South Burlington.
All right. That's Missy Mackin and Ronnie Basden from Vermont Works to Women. Listeners, to learn more about Trailblazers, go to vtworksforwomen.org. Ronnie, Missy, great having you on this morning. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Take care. We're going to take a break. Then we'll be back to hear how National Life Group is getting involved in the community. Today at 1 o'clock, Greg Hooker, the full-blown three-hour version of The Getaway. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Vermont is incredible for a number of reasons. One of those is the number of nonprofit organizations that find niches to help those in need. But for those efforts to work, it takes the support of the community by way of volunteers and financial backing. One organization that has committed itself to helping these organizations is the National Life Group in Montpelier. Joining me now to discuss some of those efforts is Beth Rusnak. She's president of the National Life Group Foundation and assistant vice president of corporate marketing and community relations for National Life. Beth, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks so much, Rick. It's good to be here.
Great to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Beth about the work of the National Life Group Foundation, you can call us 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Beth, start us off with a little history of the National Life Group in Vermont.
Sure. So National Life was established way back in 1848. I'm very proud of the fact that the company has been doing good since then. It has always been community-minded. And interestingly, even though we are headquartered in Montpelier, we happen to also, by the way, have another campus in Dallas, Texas, the company's founders have always looked to the company to be a national company, national in scope. So fast forward to today, we are one of the fastest-growing life insurance companies in the United States. Last I had heard, we are the fastest-growing. And as we continue to grow, we continue to look for new ways to help those in our community.
Yeah. Tell us how National Life has incorporated its commitment to the community into the fabric of the company's daily mission.
Sure. So there are so many ways that we do that. One of the ways is that we do have a charitable foundation. Our foundation has been around since 2006, even though prior to that, the company did so much good in the community. An example is in the flood of 92, the small businesses in Montpelier were underwater, and National Life sent down some of our employees to hand them checks just as a vote of confidence that they would be able to rebuild and come back better than ever. And we still hear today from some of those folks what a huge difference that made. Today, our foundation has a budget of $2 million. We turn that right back around. We spend down every penny that goes back into support in our communities, primarily Central and Northern Vermont and Dallas, Texas. We also have a handful of other programs. One that we're very proud of is called Life Changer of the Year, and that rewards and recognizes teachers all across the United States. So this is a national program. Mm-hmm. I encourage anybody who knows somebody who works in a school, it could be a bus driver or a food service worker or a superintendent or a school counselor, a school nurse, who are incredibly important this year, certainly, to nominate them at lifechangeroftheyear.com. And then we also have really deep connections. That's one of the things I'm most proud of, is it includes the relationships that we have with our community partners, because when we work together, it's really remarkable how we're able to lift our communities in ways we haven't imagined before.
Now, Beth, when someone says to me, doing good since 1848, normally I would correct their grammar and say doing well, but I know that you have a motto, a credo at National Life Group: do good, be good, make good. Explain what that means.
Absolutely. It's funny, I'll admit, as a as an English major from long ago.
It hurt to say it, didn't it?
There was very active discussion around that. And let me tell you a little bit about that, too, because there really were debates around those words. And what we realized is, for example, if I said, hey, Rick, how are you? And you said, I'm good. It's genuine. Mm-hmm. It's real. And yeah, that's who National Life is. And it's not to say that we don't believe in proper grammar, but what we do believe in are real, authentic relationships. And whether it's in the products we sell, life insurance and annuities, or the way in we reach out. So you're absolutely right. Our values, which were created by one of our favorite people who just retired, Chris Graff, they are do good, be good, and make good. And they reflect our actions, our intentions, and the outcomes of those actions.
All right. Now, last year, National Life stepped in to help the Thanksgiving dinner in Montpelier. So give the details of what happened last year.
Sure. So, of course, the pandemic hit us all really hard. And it had been a struggle for so many folks. First of all, dealing with hunger. As many of us remember, instances of food insecurity just spiked. It was devastating for so many people. And then we heard that the free community Thanksgiving meal that the Washington County Youth Service Bureau Boys and Girls Club had hosted for 47 years, they just simply didn't have the resources to be able to pull it off again. Understandably, first of all, we couldn't sit side by side in the Bethany Church as we had in years past. But moreover, it's a huge logistical effort. So the fact that not only would folks be going without food, they'd be going without a traditional Thanksgiving meal. And we didn't want that to happen. So we reached out to our friends at Sodexo, who they run our cafeteria at National Life in Montpelier, as well as the majority of cafeterias in Vermont's colleges and many others. They immediately said yes. They were incredible. And then we continued, I mentioned earlier, connections we reached out to other community partners, the Vermont Food Bank, Just Basics, Vermont Creamery, Cabot Cheese, and Hannaford goes on. We were able to provide 820 meals last year, safely distributed from our campus in Bethany Church.
Wow. So will that be happening again this year?
As a matter of fact, yes, and more so. So this year, Washington County Youth Service Bureau came back, and they said, unfortunately, they don't expect, because, again, of resources, that they will be able to manage this going forward at all. So we tapped Sodexo on the shoulder again, and remarkably, they didn't even hesitate, and they said, absolutely, we're in. So here we go again. This year we are planning on making 1,000 meals. They will, again, be distributed at our location in Montpelier as well as Bethany Church on Wednesday, November 24th, so the day before Thanksgiving. We will also do delivery. So this is for Washington County residents, and it is the traditional Thanksgiving meal. I will admit, it was very difficult, but I didn't taste any last year, but boy, did it look good. It was turkey, stuffing, potatoes, squash, cranberry sauce, rolls and butter, gravy, and then apple crust for dessert. And it was all packaged beautifully and distributed right in folks' cars when they pull up around our roundabout or down at Bethany Church. They could walk up and pick it up if they'd like, or as I mentioned, we'll deliver it.
Will you need help? Can community members get involved?
Yes. So we do need volunteer drivers if anyone is interested in helping. Again, we're only able to do this in Washington County, so we're looking at those routes. They should be relatively small. We're asking if anybody would need to enter the building that they need to be vaccinated. But most people last year, folks just drove right through. We loaded their cars up. We gave them a map and addresses, and they delivered the meals, and they were on their way. So we're looking for folks to deliver meals from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. again on Wednesday, November 24th.
And how would somebody get involved if they're interested?
All they have to do is give us a call at 802-229-7300. So it's 802-229-7300. Or they could email us at giving@nationallife.com.
Years ago, I was in a group called Sertoma, and we would deliver food boxes at Thanksgiving to families in need. And I got to say, there may be nothing I've ever done in my entire life that is as gratifying as showing up with that box of food at that time of year. So it really is a pretty special thing. What are some other projects, Beth, that National Life Group employees get involved in?
Oh, my gosh, there are so many. So speaking of volunteering, National Life encourages all of us to use 40 hours paid volunteer time annually. So we will have a handful of employee volunteers for this Thanksgiving meal. But there's so much that our team gets involved in the communities. You'll often see their black shirts, and it says Do Good on the back in green, whether it's Habitat for Humanity or Central Vermont Humane Society or pulling potatoes at the farm at VYCC. They're really involved. But one very exciting thing I'm so happy to announce, and keep your fingers crossed, is that we're planning another Do Good Fest for 2022. July 16th, we're looking at that date. Do Good Fest, again, is National Life's benefit concert. It benefits our friends and patients at Central Vermont Medical Center at UVM's CVMC. And we're working right now to try to figure out who we could land as far as musicians go. We're doing a lot of planning.
How much has that raised through the years so far?
So far through the years, it's raised over $250,000, so over $250,000. For the Branches of Hope Cancer Patient Fund. So this is a fund that when cancer patients have to make really horrific decisions between whether or not they pay for the fuel to heat their house or tires for their car or food, for example, let's talk about food again, or their chemo. People should not have to make those decisions, but sadly some do. So the Cancer Patient Fund reaches out and helps them with those. So in the past, the nurses, to their great credit, used to fund this fund with bake sales. So we're really proud to be able to help boost that a little bit.
All right. Do Good Fest. Anyone who's attended knows it's a great day at National Life. Tentatively set for July 16th of 2022. And we'll definitely be talking with Beth for more details as they start to firm up. Have you seen National Life support for an organization that you've been involved with? You can give us a call and let us know. And we've got Stephen on the line from Montpelier. Hi, Stephen. Go right ahead.
Hi, Rick. I just have a question for Beth.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm particularly interested in Montpelier projects, and I am wondering whether National Life is giving any support to the new Confluence Park project at the confluence of the North Branch and the main stem of Winooski.
All right, Stephen, thanks for that question. Beth, do you know?
I could actually answer that. I'm unfamiliar with that project, but we're always interested in learning about new projects in our community. So, Stephen, if you want to email us, I mentioned that it's the same website. It goes directly to me and my colleague, giving@nationallife.com. Would love to talk to you more about it and learn more about it.
All right. That's giving@nationallife.com, Stephen, and send Beth an email, and she'll look into it. I know National Life always mentions dedicated to keeping its promises. Explain in what way that happens, Beth.
Absolutely. So one of the big ways, of course, as I mentioned, is through our life insurance and annuity products. So we have some policy owners who have been with us for 60 or 70 years. And, of course, our promise to them is that we will be there when they need for us to be. The same for annuities. As folks are planning for their retirement, they want to make sure that they have something that they could fall back on. But for me and from our area, one big aspect of this, too, is keeping our promises to our community. So strong communities help build strong businesses. It's completely interwoven in a codependent relationship. So the more we could lift those in our communities, the better off we all are. And if we could give back in any way that we can, whether it's providing free meals to those who need it, to helping build houses, we've had puppy adoption days, for example, on our campus. However we could help, we're in.
Well, you have a program called Main Street Across America. What is that?
That is a program that we have had that really focuses on our main streets. We would highlight different main streets exactly all across America in different communities because we recognize that really the hub of so much activity and community is often in those small businesses on those main streets. And we just look at, for example, Montpelier and what that looks like and how it's remarkable. You walk down the street and folks know each other and everybody is there to support one another. So that was one of the programs that we had highlighted. One of the things that we had recently gotten involved in was an effort it was a statewide effort, and actually it's still ongoing, with the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston called the Working Communities Challenge. We partnered with a number of different funders, with the state, with other organizations to provide grants to communities that were struggling. These are very large grants. They had to fill out applications. They were reviewed by a steering committee. And there were 8 applications that were chosen, and they're just remarkable. Some of the communities include the Northeast Kingdom as a whole region, for example, Winooski, Springfield, the St. Albans area. And again, working together, partnering together to help those, to bring back the local economy, to bring back community so that it's thriving.
Beth, you recently wrote a great piece for National Life's Main Street blog about a gentleman who wasn't able to get life insurance back in 1955. So can you share that story with us?
Oh, I would love to. It's just an incredible story. So back in March, we had one of our customer service folks reach out to me and let me know that they received a very basic, simple letter, typewritten from a policy owner that said, Dear National Life, in 1955, you took a chance on me. I was just entering the Naval Flight Academy, and I was newly married, and no one would insure me, but you did. To thank you, I would like to surrender my policy and give the proceeds to the National Life Group Foundation. As I mentioned, I'd never seen a letter like that before. No one's ever offered that before. We typically don't accept outside donations. But it was just an incredible story. So I was thinking through, as I mentioned, all of our money from the foundation goes right back into our communities. Who do we donate this to? I was thinking veterans organizations, since this gentleman was with the Naval Flight Academy, and I thought, well, let me just call him myself. So I called. His number was on his letter. His wife thought I was a telemarketer. Luckily, she put me through. And I had the most lovely conversation by a gentleman by the name of Dan Fuss. He and I spoke for 45 minutes. And again, he explained to me that he was indebted to National Life for insuring him at this time. And 66 years later, he wanted to turn this around. I asked him if he had any causes that were near and dear to his heart. And he shared with me that he and his wife, Rosemary, tragically lost their son to suicide 15 years ago. And they established the Tommy Fuss Center at Boston Children's Hospital. This is a center that is looking into the research and focusing on the neurological aspects of adolescent mental illness. The coincidence here is that also in March at National Life, we decided we have a corporate cause, which is to help end childhood hunger in Vermont. We adopted a second cause, and that was to support children's mental health.
Mm-hmm.
So the irony is that he sends this letter pretty much on the same day that we say, you know, how about we focus on children's mental health? So we are now in very deep conversations with Boston Children's Hospital, with another organization called the National Coalition for Safe Schools, and a handful of other partners to determine the best way that we could really help kids and their families who are struggling with mental health issues.
What a story. I get a little misty every time I think about it. Also, in your commitment to mental health, we have a couple minutes, but tell us how your IT department has stepped up in that area.
We have such great employees. They're really just incredible people who I have the joy and pleasure of working with every day. So our IT department reached out to me and said, hey, we are getting our team members new laptops, but the quote old laptops are still perfectly functional. They still work. Is there anything we could do with them? And I said, heck yeah, there's a lot we could do with them. Let's reach out and find out. So over the past 2 years, really since the pandemic hit, our IT department has refurbished over 200 laptops, and we've donated those to organizations like Prevent Child Abuse Vermont and Washington County Mental Health. We just donated, a handful to Central Vermont Adult Basic Education. And these have been going to clients of these nonprofits who desperately need telehealth. They need remote access to access these services that they didn't have before. So these laptops have literally been a lifeline for some of these folks. And the fact that our IT department thought to do that and were able to is just so gratifying.
Oh, that's fantastic. Beth Rusnak is president of the National Life Group Foundation, assistant vice president of corporate marketing and community relations for National Life. And listeners, as Beth mentioned earlier, if you're interested in helping out with the Montpelier Thanksgiving dinner, 229-7300, you can call and volunteer. Beth, thank you so much for being on the program this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Rick.
You too. Take care. All right, let's take a break for CBS News and get an update there. Then we're going to head out to the Pickle Patch. Just wait. And a reminder that coming up today at 11 o'clock after Vermont Viewpoint, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I read a great piece in the Addison Independent recently about field hockey, a sport that I've really come to enjoy in the last few years. The item was from a blog called The Pickle Patch. This just kept getting better, and it's written by Faith Gong. I had to find her, and she's here now to talk about pickle patches and field hockey, whatever else we can squeeze into this next half hour. Faith, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much for inviting me to join you, Rick. I'm delighted to be here.
It's our delight. And listeners, if you're a field hockey fan or you follow Faith's blog, The Pickle Patch, you can call us 244-1777, 877-291-8255, the email address vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, Faith, what is The Pickle Patch?
Well, The Pickle Patch is a blog that was started back when my oldest child, who is now 13, was 9 months old. It really started embarrassingly as a mommy blog that I was writing primarily for our friends and family. At this point, we were not living in Vermont. We were living in California. My husband was in graduate school in economics, and he was heading over to East Africa to do some research. And I had a nine-month-old and was a first-time parent and wasn't excited about being alone for a month or more with this new baby. So I decided to go over to Northern Virginia, where my parents lived at the time, and stay with them for the summer. And because we had friends and my husband's entire family back in California, I thought, well, I'll start a blog just to keep our friends and family posted with what's happening with the baby. As a first-time parent, I assumed that everybody was going to be fascinated with what was going on with our with our baby. And then by 2011, which was when we moved to Vermont, we had three children, and I was even starting to bore myself. You know, by the time you have three kids, the first steps and the first words aren't quite as interesting. And so I thought, I really need a reason to keep this blog going beyond just appealing to grandparents, or I'll just stop doing it. And it was right then that we moved to Vermont, and Vermont proved to be the inspiration to keep it going and take it in a new direction. So that's essentially what The Pickle Patch is. It's changed over the years from something that was just focused on our kids and our family and has become much more a record of our life in Vermont.
But tell people now how many children you have and their ages.
Yes. So now we have five children and they range in age from 13. Then we have a 12-year-old, a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, and our son will be 2 a week from today.
Wow. Oh, congratulations. All those times. All right. And what, now that it's not so much a mommy blog, what do you generally write about?
Well, now I have much less time with five children. And I also, a side note here is I homeschool half of those children, my two youngest daughters. So what I really am focusing on is a biweekly column that I write for the Addison County Independent, which is our local newspaper. Mm-hmm. It runs every other Tuesday on their online site. And that's the article that you wrote. So at the moment, my blog primarily involves links to my columns that I write because that's what my life capacity is right now. Although every once in a while, I'll write something that's a little bit more personal about our life in Vermont. And we have quite a lot going on with five children and a dog and a cat and a whole mess of poultry. And so I focus on what our experiences have been. And that too has changed as we've been in Vermont for a decade.
Mm. Is it cathartic writing The Pickle Patch?
It really is. You know, it's something that is really my journal, I have come to realize. I'm not very disciplined about keeping a journal. But over the past couple of years, my oldest daughter in particular has started going back and reading my old columns. Mm. And she's really enjoyed it from the standpoint of, oh, remember that happened to our family when I was younger. And she'll even cite things that I have forgotten, but I'm so grateful that I wrote them down
back
10 years ago.
Wow. Now, do you ever hear from any of the kids, do not write about this?
You know, it's so funny, Rick. Actually, one of the ways that I would say my writing, my blog and my column have really changed, especially recently, is that I try so much to protect my children and their privacy. So I will no longer use names. I try to shy away from anything that I think might be embarrassing to them. And so I try so hard to be sensitive. And then they read what I write, and they're so delighted whenever I mention them. They say, well, don't worry about that. We just love it when you write about us. So that's funny. I think they're a lot less shy than I am. But maybe they won't feel that way in 20 years. So
yeah.
I still try to protect them a bit.
In 20 years, I'm sure they'll be fine. It's those difficult teen years that you're just
right.
entering into that could be the toughest. All right, let's talk field hockey. First of all, did you ever play field hockey?
I never played field hockey. No, neither my husband nor I were ever team sports people. My husband was a cross-country runner in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I had nothing to do with athletics at all. I was the drama club literary magazine kid.
Ah, yeah, that kid. Well,
yeah.
Who did play it when you were in school?
When I was in school, the field hockey girls, because it was always girls,
right.
interestingly, I've found that in America, the sport is very female-dominated.
Mm-hmm.
The girls were the golden girls of my high school. I went to high school in the Northern Virginia suburbs of Washington, D.C., and they were the ones with the beautiful hair, and they were so popular, but also the nice girls, you know, the popular, nice, smart girls, just the girls who I could never, never pretend to be. And I just remember them gliding down the hall. They would wear their uniforms on game day, which at that time were collared shirts and mm-hmm. these beautiful plaid kilts.
Right.
So that was what I associated field hockey with, this kind of preppy ideal at the time.
When I was in high school, we actually got to play it a couple times in my gym class. And
oh.
I know it really was kind of cool because, you know, we love playing street hockey. We love playing floor hockey. And we thought, oh, great, you know, field hockey. And it's a different animal. You can only use that one side of the stick and you're bent over. And it's like, how do they do this? Not an easy sport to play. It's pretty rugged.
Yes, it is.
All right. So how did you get introduced to field hockey in this phase of your life?
Well, by 2019, we had pretty much given up on the idea that our particular brood of children were ever going to be involved in team sports.
Mm-hmm.
Like most parents, we had tried to introduce them to a range of things. We had tried soccer. We tried lacrosse. We tried swimming, the whole gamut. And our kids were dutifully try for a season and then say, well, all right, that was fun, but I'm done with that. And then in 2019, a friend of ours mentioned to me that her daughters, who were friends with my daughters, were going to be doing this youth field hockey clinic. And it happens to be run by a friend of ours named Chelsea Giuliani. Chelsea played field hockey at Middlebury High School, and then she went on to coach in high school sports in Vermont, most recently at Middlebury High School. And she was running a field hockey clinic for girls who were ages, I believe at the time it was about 5 through 11, so before you would get to the middle school, high school level. And her great desire was just to introduce a younger generation to the sport so that they might be interested in playing on the middle school and high school teams. And this was also co-sponsored by Middlebury College. So the wonderful thing about it was $10 per
per participant.
Nice.
Which is unheard of. And they would throw in a field hockey stick.
Love it.
But, you know, this is my girls' friends are doing this, which is a motivator there that they could see their friends. And my goodness, if they don't love it, it's the cost of a few fancy cups of coffee. So we tried it. I actually started out with just my two oldest girls doing it. And at the end of that fall youth clinic, all four of my girls were playing. They were, at the time, I believe they were ages 5 to 11, because the oldest girls loved it so much and the younger ones saw them loving it so much. My 9-year-old at the time came off of her first practice and just said, "I found my sport." So we went from having a very bookish, artistic, unathletic brood to having these four girls who were just passionate about field hockey.
Oh my gosh, I love it. Here's how it happened for me. My best friend Rob was at home, and his wife Ann, who had her best friend over on a fall Saturday. The women needed to talk. Rob was told he had several hours to go out and do something, anything. So he went to a nearby college thinking he'd watch a game. Alas, the football team was on the road, same with the soccer teams, but there was something going on, field hockey. This was at Westchester University, one of the best programs in Division II, the defending champs right now. He was amazed at the sport he was watching, the skills, and he was hooked. And he's made me a fan as well. When he's visited, we've traveled all over, New Hampshire, New York, Mass., up to McGill for a weekend tournament. It was a frigid weekend. The players never flinched when they were hit by sticks or balls. With me now discussing a piece she wrote about her daughters choosing to play field hockey is Faith Gong. She writes the Pickle Patch blog, and it's reprinted by a number of newspapers. If you've got a question for Faith or you want to share a comment about field hockey, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. I probably shouldn't ask Faith, but I get the feeling you're pretty honest when you blog. Are your daughters any good at field hockey?
You know, here is what I would say.
Okay.
I would say, quite honestly, I don't think you could call any of my daughters a standout star on their team. But what has been exciting to see is they're all progressing. So they're all developing skills. And my oldest girls are runners, and so that really shines on the field. My oldest daughter in particular runs like a colt. It's just beautiful to see her in motion. And my younger two, who are still on the youth level, so doing unofficial sports, really, they are so enthusiastic. And my third daughter in particular is probably the least athletically inclined. And this year, she just became what her grandfather called a typhoon on the field. And my very youngest one is so much fun to watch because she just leaps across the field. She kind of skips to the ball. So I would say, are they incredible athletes at the moment? No, but they love it so much, and they're having so much fun, and they are improving, and that's really what brings me joy, watching them.
Heart can take you a long way in athletics. Now, how did things ramp up for your family this field hockey season?
Yes, well, we began playing, if you remember, I said, in 2019. Mm-hmm. And then 2020, of course, was the pandemic season of field hockey. So my three youngest daughters continued with a couple times a week with the youth program run by Chelsea Giuliani that they had begun in. But my oldest daughter moved up to play at our local middle school. However, because of COVID, it was not a normal season. So they only had two practices a week. I believe there was only one game the entire season. They were all masked the entire time. Then this year, I had two girls playing at the middle school level, and it became a normal season, which meant practices for 90 minutes, 5 days a week, a game at least once a week, often away.
sometimes away games involve an hour or more of driving. And I still had two in the youth program 2 days a week. So we were running all over the place every afternoon for field hockey. The season began in late August. It ended just this week. Our final party was October 19th. So that doesn't seem like a long season, but it seemed like a lot being in the car every afternoon. And I'll just add, my two middle schoolers do not actually attend our local public middle school where they play field hockey. They attend a little private school up the mountain about 20 minutes away, and this school does not offer field hockey. So I would have to drive up there every afternoon, pick them up, and run them down to their practice, which began at the exact time that their school ended. So we were constantly late and driving up and down mountains all fall.
Oh, my. Now, how have your daughters been through this busy field hockey season? Ready to hang up the sticks?
Absolutely not. And it's funny, when we began the school year and we knew what it would look like, we had a very frank talk as a family. And we said, we will try this, we will see how it goes, and if it is too much, we will adjust. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, they're going to last a week, maybe two, once things get going and they have homework. And quite to the contrary, they really thrived. I was amazed. My oldest daughter, in fact, when I checked in with her about midway through the season, said, you know, it's just such a delight to be outside running around after a day at school. It's just exactly what I need. So I was really happy at their perseverance and also really tired.
Well, yeah. What kind of toll has it taken on you and your husband this season?
Well, it's taken a toll on our gas mileage, for sure. I, for the first time, I believe, in my life, was using an entire tank of gas every week. I think it's taken a toll on our one-year-old, our almost two-year-old, because he's the one who had to be in the car running around without the benefit of having a sport at the end of the drive.
Right.
So after 2 hours of him being in the car, I would almost apologize. I would say, oh my goodness, are you even able to stand upright anymore? Are you melded into the shape of your car seat at this point? But, you know, my husband and I would say we were incredibly ready for the season to end when it did. It felt like energy-wise we were limping across the finish line a bit. But again, the really important thing for us was that our girls were loving it so much. Yeah. And I think when you see your children thrive, and I think especially after the past 18 months that they've had, where so much has been canceled and they felt so isolated, I was happy to make those drives.
Yeah. Well, you've had, you know, what, the end of the season was the 18th, the party the 19th, so you've had all of 2 days to relax. Faith, I love the sport, but I can probably spot one foul with any confidence, and that's when it hits somebody's foot. But I'm glad to know that I now have you to explain the rules to me, right?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. So we have wonderful grandparents these are my parents who used to live in Northern Virginia and moved up to Vermont when they retired, and they would come to every single field hockey game. And my father in particular was just maddened that he could not understand why the ref was blowing the whistle every couple of minutes. And so he would ask me, what's going on? What just happened? I would say, I don't know. I have no idea. And come to find out that many of the parents on the sidelines had no idea. It feels like there's just an infinite number of ways that you can be fouled in field hockey. So I know, yes, if you touch the ball with your foot, if you hit the ball with the wrong side of the stick, if any part of your body comes between your opponent and the ball, if you cross sticks, but beyond that, I really couldn't tell you. It was unclear.
Well, the good part is it keeps the crowd from arguing with the referees too much. Now, I also know on your blog you like to let people know what you are reading. Have you read We Ride Upon Sticks by Quan Berry?
I have not, but I am writing that down right now.
We Ride Upon Sticks. You must get that. Quan Berry is the author.
Right, a book about field hockey.
Exactly. You're going to love it. All right. Faith Gong writes The Pickle Patch, which is also printed in the Addison Independent. You can find her blog at thepicklepatch.com. Faith, thanks so much for telling us about it this morning. It was great fun.
Thank you so much for having me on, Rick.
All right, take care. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading the podcast at wdevradio.com. It is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. We've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Singeri. Tomorrow we got Bob Ney. We're going to talk about making great pies. That's going to be very interesting. The history of Berlin. We're going to talk about Tech Jam. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.